You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Front One.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, July 21st, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the wonderful and lovely Ari Berman from Nation Magazine will be here to talk to us about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Elizabeth Warren, out, essentially fired, as far as I'm concerned, by the Obama administration. Who will take her place? Well, we know, a guy named Cordray. Will he be confirmed by the Senate? Probably not. Have I just completely depleted everything to talk to Ari about? No, there'll be more. And later in the program, my co-host, one of them, from Ring of Fire, Mike Papantonio. We had talked about the News Corp, the Murdoch family's testimony, I should say. And his perspective on this is fascinating. He has sat in a courtroom for 26 years across a courtroom from corporate CEOs, essentially trying to get out of criminal liability. And his insights on this are fascinating. We will talk to him. And later in the post show, I will break down and talk about, no, I'm not break down, but I will break down Cenk's announcement that he is off of MSNBC. And we'll play a clip of his announcement from his show and talk about it. I have some thoughts. Why wouldn't I? I've been over at MSNBC, not paid. I just go over there. I just do a lot of pro bono work for them because I'm so concerned about Comcast and GE's bottom line that I head over there. I do a little pro bono work for them. Cenk out at MSNBC, and at least in part by his own volition. Interesting story. In many ways, impressive. And we will discuss that. But this quick note, and this file this in the
surprise.
We are on the verge of defaulting on our national debt. There is a group of now almost 80 to 100 Republican freshmen in the House, part of the so-called Tea Party Caucus, or I don't know if they're the official Tea Party Caucus, who are refusing to pay the nation's bills. Remember, the debt ceiling is raised because we have already made commitments. There is no cuts at this point that the U.S. government can make that will prevent us from having to raise the debt ceiling, because the debt ceiling actually pays for commitments we have already made. You understand that? You could cut every dollar out of the federal budget going forward, you would still have to raise the debt ceiling. And nothing exemplifies the Tea Party mentality about paying your bills than this story. On Monday, The Venetian Casino Resort, LLC, filed suit against the Tea Party Nation Corporation of Franklin, Tennessee, alleging the group owes $642,000.
Hey, what happened?
For canceling a conservative conclave last year. Well, not just for canceling it, for not paying their bill. The event had been scheduled for July 14th, 2010. Nobody signed up for it, so they pushed it to October. Nobody signed up for it, and so
Surprise.
They had to cancel. But the Daily Caller, the right-wing Daily Caller, I should add, reported at the time there was a lack of people willing to pay $399 for a weekend pass or $125 a day to hear speakers such as conservative commentator Laura Ingraham or politician Sharon Engel. Really? Really? They couldn't find people to pay that? I'm shocked. Frankly, you'd have to pay me double that to go to Vegas and watch those people speak. I'm sitting in Vegas and I got to hear Laura Ingraham speak. I can hear her speak on the radio every day. And I wouldn't pay anything for that either. The reservation included an agreement by the Tea Party Nation to pay the resort $579,000 in the event of a cancellation, of which the resort alleges the group still owes $554,000. And then I guess there's some interest charge. So basically, the Tea Party thought they were much larger and much more interesting than they are. They signed up to reserve God knows how many rooms, $550,000 worth of rooms.
It was over 1,000, I think actually closer to 2,000.
2,000 rooms. And no one shows. And then what do? They chewed and screwed, ladies and gentlemen. Just like they want to do with the country's debts. We've chewed. We've got our Medicare. We've got our Social Security. We've got our government services. And now we don't want to pay for it. Bye-bye. Nothing says Tea Party more than not paying your bills. We got to take a break, folks. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ari Berman of The Nation. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, it is always a pleasure to welcome to this program the lovely and bright Ari Berman from The Nation magazine. Ari, welcome to the program.
Sam, it's always a pleasure to talk to the brilliant and beautiful Sam Cedar.
Thank you. You obviously were sharp enough to realize that I was fishing for something like that.
Oh, yeah, and I knew you wanted some alliteration in response, so I gave you both.
Oh, this is why you are such an esteemed writer.
We have to chuckle in these dark times.
No kidding. I'll tell you something. It really is dark, but let's go from just extremely hazy and cloudy and to pitch black, okay, over the course of this interview.
Can we get a little 100-degree weather in there, too?
No kidding. Well, fortunately, we'll put, according to Rush Limbaugh, that's just the government conspiracy. It's not really as hot as you think it is. It's just the government's fudging with the numbers so that Al Gore can make more money. But
they forgot to turn on the air conditioning in heaven, I guess.
That's right. Yeah, God said, yeah, God decided not to, God's not doing that. God's focusing on preventing contraception from being handed out.
God just doesn't want taxes to be raised.
That's right. That is, well, and we'll get to that. We'll get to the debt ceiling. But first, okay, a year ago, we're on an anniversary, right, of the...
On an anniversary, not your anniversary.
Not my personal anniversary, because I would never remember that. We're on an anniversary of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Is that correct?
Yes, we are. And of Dodd-Frank in general.
Where are we a year later? A year sure. later, 2 years later, year later.
Sure. Yeah. So this is where we are at right now. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau officially goes live today. But there is a major hitch, which is that if the Bureau does not have a full-time confirmed director, which it does not have, then it cannot assume a number of new powers and cannot assume essentially overseeing and regulating all the different aspects of the shadow banking industry. It can look at the major banks, it can supervise them, but it doesn't really have any teeth until it gets a director. And so for months now, and we've been talking about this on the show, for months now, people have been wondering, well, will Elizabeth Warren, whose idea this was, who was named the advisor and the interim director of the Bureau, will she be named the director? We found out this week that the Obama administration decided not to name her the full-time director. They instead named Rich Cordray, who was head of enforcement at the CFPB under Warren and who is a former attorney general in Ohio, would instead be the director. Unfortunately, the administration doesn't seem to have a plan to actually get him in there. Republicans have made it very clear that they're not going to confirm anyone to the CFPB without major changes to the Bureau. The administration says they're not going to agree to these changes. So basically what's going to happen is it seems like a recess appointment will be inevitable, but we don't know, okay, well, does the Obama administration want a vote on him and then he'll get rejected, and they can say, okay, now we'll recess him, or are they just going to recess him? When will Congress even recess at this point? Because they've been talking about the debt ceiling. They've been in session because of the debt ceiling for weeks now without actually taking a break. So the authority of the CFPB and when there will actually be a director, as you said, remains hazy.
All right. There's a lot of other sort of subsidiary questions here. The first is, do you think there was ever a time where the Obama administration was ever contemplating? I mean, well, let's start with this. Did the Obama administration essentially fire Elizabeth Warren here?
Essentially, yes. I mean, she wanted the job. A lot of people were pushing her for the job. It always seemed like they were resistant, but no one knew what was going to happen. I mean, as recently as a month ago, I talked to Barney Frank, who's the ranking Democrat on the House Financial Services Committee, and Frank said that he thought Warren was still the front runner for the job and pressure was building for her to be put in there, especially since the Senate said they won't confirm anybody, which made it more likely that you could just put Warren in there via recess appointment. For a while, the argument was, okay, well, she can't get 60 votes, and that's why she was named a special advisor to Obama and the interim director of the Bureau as opposed to the full-time director. And perhaps that was the case back in the fall of 2010. But at this point in time, they could have just put her in there via a recess appointment. They didn't want to pick this fight. And I don't think they wanted to pick the fight for a few different reasons. One reason is that they feel like they need GOP support to raise the debt ceiling. They don't want to do anything that will jeopardize that support. Number two, they are trying to make nice with Wall Street, to rebuild their relationship with Wall Street and to raise as much money from Wall Street for the 2012 reelection campaign. Warren is a liability for that. And kind of concurrently, she goes against the message of the administration right now. I mean, she is a fighter. She is someone who fights the banks. And the way the administration operates right now is very much in the spirit of triangulation and cooperation and compromise, and she doesn't really fit into that scheme of theirs right now.
So let me see if I got this straight. They don't really want Warren, even though they know that she cannot get passed through the Senate because they're afraid that they're going to have to recess appoint her if they decide that she is the person. So they pick this other guy, Cordray. We'll talk about him in a second. But they know that he can't pass through the Senate because the Senate is going to block him. So they may or may not recess appoint him. But they would rather, if they have to recess appoint somebody, they would rather recess him. Well, let me ask you this. Why have they waited so long? I mean,
I think this hasn't, it has not been a priority for them. I mean, Dodd-Frank in general, financial reform in general, has not been a priority for them. Again, for I think a few different reasons. Number one, just because there's been so much stuff going on otherwise, the government shutdown and the debt ceiling fight. And then number two, I don't think it's a coincidence that the administration is raising all this money for Wall Street. They're under all this pressure from financial industry lobbyists at the same time that Dodd-Frank is lagging. I mean, I think there's a lot of pressure on them to go as slow as possible in implementing this reform law. And the CFPB, as I wrote in The Nation last month, has been one of the major targets of the financial industry in terms of what they want to weaken in Dodd-Frank. And so getting rid of Elizabeth Warren, doing this as slowly as possible is a major priority for Wall Street, and they've been able to influence the Obama administration on this score.
So basically, the Obama administration doesn't even want to fill this spot because they don't want this thing to kick in, but they've covered themselves in the event that they're actually forced by some circumstance or they need to throw somebody a bone. If they need to make a recess appointment and they have the opportunity to do so, they have a guy in there who still is not the avowed enemy or perceived as the avowed enemy of Wall Street.
Well, the thing is I don't know for a fact that they don't want to fill it. I'm just saying they don't have an end game here. I mean, getting rid of Warren and replacing her with Cordray didn't actually solve any of their problems in terms of getting a director, because it's not like they said, okay, we have a director, and now we know we can recess appointment him during the August recess. And probably that's what's likely to happen. But again, the end game here of trying to say, okay, we really want the Senate to confirm him. The Senate's already made clear that they're not going to confirm him. So I don't know if this is just them trying to win the PR war and paint the GOP as further obstructionist. But Obama's been very, very reluctant to use his recess authority. I mean, he's only made 28 recess appointments, which is a very, very small number, because the Senate has blocked 20% of his nominees. They've blocked over 353 of his nominees. In response, Obama's only made 28 recess appointments. So on this score, at least, he's been very unwilling to use his executive authority. He's used it in a lot of other cases that we don't like, but he hasn't used it in this case in terms of filling crucial vacancies in his administration.
What do you think Elizabeth Warren is going to do now? I mean, do you think she should run for Senate? There's a big debate on the left about this, because clearly the administration somehow, I mean, there has been virtually no outcry about Warren being fired here. And maybe it was because people expected it, maybe because there is no, there very well may never be an appointment to head this agency in the midterm or short term. For whatever reason, there hasn't been a tremendous outcry about this.
Yeah.
It's just one more thing that Obama has done that, is clearly not in line with liberals' hopes, I guess.
Well, some of us have been talking about it. I mean, I think there's two reasons why there hasn't been as much of an outcry. I mean, number one is that people think that Rich Cordray, her replacement, will be a strong candidate. He won't have the gravitas or the expertise or the Washington wherewithal of Warren, but they think that he nonetheless has a strong record. So I guess, as with a lot of things in Obama, they feel like it could have been a lot worse.
Right.
And then the second thing is that people have convinced themselves that having someone who can defeat Scott Brown is more important than having someone who can run an agency, which I think is a completely ridiculous and absurd argument, because this is a new bureau that will have a lot of stature if it gets up and running in the right way, that could do a lot of good in people's lives, whereas the Senate is basically completely dysfunctional and broken. It doesn't even really matter at this point in time who is running the Senate, because nothing gets done regardless. So fine, I mean, yeah, it would be nice to replace Elizabeth Warren with Scott Brown, maybe she can become another Paul Wellstone. Maybe she can influence the political debate, but that's probably the most she's going to do. I mean, no legislation is passing through the Senate right now, and I don't see how getting Elizabeth Warren in there changes that. I also think, just from a substantive perspective, she's going to have a lot of time, have a lot of problems running against Brown. I mean, Brown is relatively well-liked in Massachusetts. She's never run for political office before. She's an untested commodity. They're going to try to stereotype her as a Cambridge liberal, a Harvard professor who's out of touch with, you know, working class Massachusetts. I don't know if that's going to stick just because of her whole record in fighting for the middle class, but she's definitely considered the underdog right now. So you took her from a position where she would have had a lot of stature and she would be leading something that she's completely comfortable with a clear mandate, to something that's a completely unknown quantity that might not happen. So I don't really see that as a victory for progressives.
I'd add a third element into this, in that she's been impeccably gracious and not frame this in the context of being fired.
She is being gracious, and she's either being gracious because she wants to remain
plugged
into the Obama administration, and she wants to be able to, for as long as possible, to kind of run this thing behind the scenes. And she knows that if she speaks out, the Obama administration will just totally throw her under the bus. And I think she's also coy because a lot of people have urged her to run for the Senate, and she's taking a close look at doing that. I do think at some point in time people are going to want to hear her speak candidly at what's happening, both from the Wall Street perspective and the Obama administration perspective, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see, because if she doesn't run for Senate, it seems to me unlikely, and it would be unfortunate if all she did was to go back, frankly, to Harvard, teach contracts, and post at TPM Cafe, you know, which is where she was 5 years ago. Not to malign TPM Cafe or Harvard, but I think that, you know, she can offer this country something more. I don't know in what context it would be best for her to do that. I mean,
given that she's not in this agency,
and she shan't be, as it were, in the in any time that we can foresee, where would you like to see her? Where do you think that she could have the most influence?
Well, I mean, if she remained basically like an outside advisor to the Bureau, without being in there, but basically with someone that, you know, Rich Cordray could bounce ideas off, you know, every single day, while speaking out and having a public profile, I mean, I think that would be pretty good. I mean, she wouldn't be running the thing, but she would still have a lot of influence there, and perhaps she has enough influence there already, just by virtue of hiring everybody and creating a culture there that's different, distinct from the Treasury Department culture or the Obama White House culture. But I mean, if she runs for a Senate, that's going to put her very far away from the CFPB and what's going on there. I mean, I think she has more to add on economic issues than just being a member of the Senate. But I mean, that's not a bad thing. Being a senator is not a bad alternative. But as I said, I don't think it's a better alternative than actually influencing the creation of an important new bureau.
All right. So let's turn now to the titular head of the Republican Party. I'm speaking of Grover Norquist. And Grover Norquist has, as you know, deemed it, has told all of the Republican legislators that you cannot raise any revenue, no new taxes, and you have to sign like a blood oath. You sign this pledge. We each like put a knife to our palm, do a blood brother thing, then we pray over the metaphorical grave of Jack Abramoff. What do you make of the reports that Norquist is now saying that if you let the Bush tax cuts expire, it's not technically raising taxes? Is he backing off this thing? Is he opening the door for this grand bargain, which everybody knows is really one of the most horrible things that we could want if we have the interest of the middle class in mind.
Yeah, I mean, Obama gave conservatives an unbelievable deal. I mean, just really like a deal they couldn't even have gotten under, no way they could have gotten under George W. Bush. But they got it under a Democratic president with the cover of a Democratic president who could try to sell it to progressives. And the Tea Party was too stupid to notice, basically, is what happened. They're so stubborn about taxes that they realized that they were missing this major opportunity to really restructure what exists of the welfare state in this country, drastically reform the tax code to favor corporations, and basically achieve these long-held priorities of the conservative movement. But they were so obsessed with taxes, partially because of the power in Grover Norquist as making this a litmus test for Republicans, that they rejected the deal. Now, I wonder if some of the slightly smarter conservatives in the Republican Party have been talking to Grover. They said, listen, all we have to do is backtrack on the Bush tax cuts, and we can raise the eligibility age of Medicare. We can restructure Social Security so that people get less benefits. We can cut trillions of dollars, a ton of money in spending. We can cut corporate taxes, and basically that's a great deal. That's a deal that we're not going to get again.
And lower the marginal tax rate, it seems like.
Absolutely, I mean, lower the
it's unclear what deal is on the table right now. I keep hearing now the $4 trillion deal has come back. But if it does include this chain CPI to Social Security, and it does include changing the age of eligibility for Medicare, am I wrong, because you're much smarter about these things than I am, in characterizing it as the single largest rollback of the New Deal since the creation of the New Deal?
I mean, you'd have to I think you're as smart as I am on this, and you probably
you're
have
smart.
To ask Paul Krugman.
Because as far as I can tell, I mean, over the years, we have added benefits to Social Security, added benefits to Medicare. But has there ever been a single moment in the past 80 years that could rival this deal in terms of turning the clock backwards?
Well, I think if you look at, for example, what Clinton did, I mean, Clinton cut, I think, you know, $200 billion or so from Medicare, but he offset it one-to-one in terms of new taxes. So it wasn't actually that horrible what he did in comparison to what Obama's offering. I mean, Reagan was able to pass a number of – I mean, I'd have to go back and look – quite frankly, at the Reagan era and see all the details of what were passed back then. But this certainly seems like the worst thing I can think of. And it's unclear what Democrats are getting in response to this deal other than the fact that they'll get to deal with some sort of tax revenue. We should mention, Sam, the Bush tax cuts are already going to expire next year. So the administration could do nothing and they would expire, which leads you to believe, why do they actually need to cut a deal to enshrine something that's going to happen anyway?
They don't want to have this fight. I mean, it is, you know, at this point, any lack of any question as to what the Obama administration motives are is in some respects a form of denial, I think.
I completely agree with you, and I think this is exactly what the Obama administration wants. They want to run in 2012 saying, we fought the liberals, we fought the left, we're the reasonable people, we're the people that cut spending, we're the people that took on entitlement programs. We made the quote-unquote tough decisions, right?
Right. And that 9.3% unemployment rate, look, does anybody we're talking to really talk to these people? Is there anybody on TV who doesn't have a job?
I think they're living in a total bubble, and I think sometimes we think that just because people are in Washington that they know what's best, and I think that's often not the case. It wasn't the case with the war in Iraq. It wasn't the case when the Bush administration decided that they wanted to privatize Social Security, and it could be right now. It certainly seems like this, that the Obama administration is in a total disconnect on the economy, where they're talking about things that nobody cares about and that, in fact, will be even more unpopular and make their road to re-election even tougher than it already is. And will really, I think, fracture and possibly in the current context destroy the current Democratic Party if they move ahead with changing these programs. I mean, I saw a poll today. I mean, 88% and 89% of Americans like Medicare and Social Security as is. They don't want to prioritize this stuff over the deficit. They want some spending cuts. They want some tax increases. They want to call it a day, and they want to move on to creating jobs, which is what the administration should be talking about every single day for the rest of Obama's term, or else there's not going to be a second term.
Well, Ari Berman of The Nation, it is always horrible to talk to
you're getting me so, you're getting me so rattled, Sam.
Always a pleasure, Ari, even when we're talking about how the sun seems to be in full eclipse and there is no future. I know there's a future because of young men like yourself, Ari, who will carry the banner.
If I could talk about Michelle Bachmann's migraines, then I'd feel better.
Yes. Well, Ari Berman of The Nation, thanks so much for joining us. I hope to talk to you
soon. Thanks, Sam. I appreciate it.
All right, folks, we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Mike Papantonio of, yes, Ring of Fire, and we'll be talking about the Murdochs right back after this. Decisions bugging me. Decision may molest me. If you don't want me, set me free. Set me free. Exactly who I'm supposed to be. Don't you know which clothes even fit me? Come on and let me know. Should I cool it or should I blow? Stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be double. So you gotta let me know. Should I cool it or should I blow? We're back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program. He is the host of Ring of Fire, which I co-host with him. It's on every weekend on Saturdays, sometimes repeated Sundays. Check your local listings. Go to ringoffireradio.com, of course, as I mention often, to find out your local listings. And you can, of course, stream it online at that time there. Mike Papantonio. Mike, welcome to the show, Pap.
Sam, how are you?
I'm doing great. Now, we spent a long time this week when we were talking about the News Corp for Ring of Fire, and I wanted to just touch base on it because your perspective on this is about as unique as it gets, because when I was watching that testimony by the Murdoch family, as it were, prior to the pie-throwing event, I didn't see what you saw until you told me about it. And so, you know, based upon your experience of sitting in a courtroom for 26 years across corporate CEOs like Murdoch, tell me what you saw in this testimony at the beginning of the week.
Sam, I saw that you could have taken the testimony, the deposition testimony, trial testimony from WorldCom, Enron, HealthSouth, Kinlay, Bernie Evers, Richard Scrooge, you could have put them side by side with what we saw playing itself out in the in that Murdoch game. And all you would have seen is this textbook criminal defense strategy, same one for Murdoch, same one for WorldCom, Enron, HealthSouth, because it's been around a long time. And this is not, there's nothing new here. They schooled him up for about a week and a half. They put him in a room. They actually focus what he says. They have people come in, usually anywhere between 15-20 people, sit in a room behind glass and listen to what he has to say, and say, well, you know, how do you like this? It's just like you would do. It's just the same way you would sell Coca-Cola. You know, what's the ad that sells Coke? So what they figured out a long time ago is you go in when you have a huge company and you say, look, the company's so big that we can't know everything.
Now, wait a second. Let me stop you here for 1 second. So, but isn't there's two aspects to this. There's the PR aspect, and there's also the legal aspect, right? I mean, so they've got
this stage is the same thing.
They're the same thing because on some level they don't necessarily run contrary to each other, but they have to be very careful how they set it up legally, and they also want to make themselves look a certain way that will give them sympathy, right?
That's exactly right. What you do, it's called backing down. It's called backing down a prosecution. And what you do with back down the prosecution is you win on the PR front, and you don't say so much on the criminal side that you hurt yourself. You go in with the textbook things like, I don't know the details, I have no knowledge, it's somebody else's fault, I wasn't there, how could I know, I can't remember, I'd love to tell you, I'd love to talk to you, but there's an ongoing investigation. It's exactly the same thing you see with Enron or Tyco or any of these companies, same thing. The problem is, at some point, you got to be careful with it, because even though there's not a formal charge called willful blindness or deliberate ignorance, it becomes part of the prosecution agenda. What you do is you say, look, you know, you're in front of a jury, you say, where you had enough information, enough constructive pieces of knowledge to conclude that you were dealing with a bunch of criminals, that the criminal conduct was taking place within your organization, you had a duty to do something. It's like, Sam, it'd be like you being in Miami, somebody saying, Sam, here's the keys of this car. Would you, if you drive it up to New York, I'm going to give you $2,000. And, oh, great, that sounds great. And you fail to look in the trunk, but in the trunk you've got a kilo of cocaine. And so when you get to New York, you can't just say, well, gee, I didn't know. Some guy came up to me, gave me $2,000. There are some things that you have to ask a question about. And so this is one of those situations. And I got to tell you, the questioning by that parliamentary committee was, you know, it was boring, it was innocuous at times. But as I was listening to it, I saw a pretty good attack unfold. They knew they couldn't accomplish a lot. They knew that they'd been this James and Murdoch and James and Rupert had been schooled up, PR'd to death, lawyered to death, and they knew they weren't going to get a lot. But they knew this. They knew there were a couple areas they could attack. One is why James paid a hacking victim £1 million, almost equivalent to $2 million. Why would they pay that person in a civil claim, as they put it, and pay everybody else that has a similar claim $20,000 to $30,000? That was the first thing they did really well. Of course, the second part of that.
Let me pause there. So there's a disparity. They had a bunch of people with presumably and ostensibly the exact same claim in terms of having been hacked by News Corp. Some got 20,000, but one got $1 million. That raises that question, like, why $1 million to that one guy?
Exactly. Yeah, this guy knew more. It was, if you go back and look at it, he was rattling sabers. He knew more. He was getting ready to cause a lot more trouble than these other people that are getting $20,000 or $30,000. So the boy, James, comes in and he pays him £1 million, $2 million. And then, you know, the idea that Rupert doesn't know about that is just absurd. I mean, look, I don't care how big the company is. When you say, look, I had to give Joe Schmo $2 million this month, it's something you talk about. So that they knew that wasn't believable. There's a great lawyer. His name is Louis Neiser. Been, you know, long, many years dead, but he wrote some great stuff about what you do on cross-examination. Is one thing is you try to get the other side to say something that just patently is not believable, and that's what this committee did a good job on. They also did a good job on developing this idea. Why did you pay this huge money for the criminal defense of an employee who is no longer with your company? I mean, you know, which they did. They paid for the criminal defense of this cat who had hacked into the phones of the royal family. And they paid for that defense after they'd gotten rid of him. They had no, they had zero contractual obligation, Sam, to pay for it. He was gone. He was at will. He's gone. He's been fired. Long after the fact, they come up and pay all this criminal defense money for the investigation, for the lawyers. Anybody looking at that is going to say, you know, looks like a duck. Quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. And the duck being that they're trying to cover up a terrible fraud that the company's been engaged in.
Well, Pap, thanks for giving us insight into this. It's you've got a unique perspective and really broke it down for me. And I've done a lot. I've gone back and I've reviewed the testimony. You're absolutely right. You know, Murdoch's whole shtick was, I didn't know about it. The company's so big. He said that twice. The company's so big. It's 1%, you know, News of the World was 1% of our operations, which it turns out to be sort of a lie. Right. And, but it's so big. I couldn't have known about it. I didn't know about it. I didn't know about it. I didn't know about it. And then James, his whole thing was, I didn't know about it till a little bit later, until after I made the mistake.
And, I knew about it, but it was later than that.
Exactly. But it's really fascinating stuff. And, folks, if you want to hear Pap and I talk more about it, make sure you tune into Ring of Fire this weekend. Pap, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Sam. Take care.
All right, folks, we got to take we got to end the show. We got to end the show. We got to end the show, ladies and gentlemen. As soon as we learn to do that, we will do that. Here we go. Folks, you can join me in the post show, Majority FM. On the IM, got a lot of calls yesterday at 646-257-3920. Call in. I'm going to be talking about Cenk gone from MSNBC. We got some audio to play there. Rush Limbaugh, the heat index is a conspiracy by the government. Of course it is. Of course it is. I'm not sitting here in a pool of my own sweat. The government has paid me to sweat. The government's paid me to sweat. I will talk about that and more in the post show. Of course, tomorrow, TGIF, Casual Friday. When I say TGIF, I am actually referring to the restaurant. I'm not referring to the day. That I don't use it in that context. I just say TGIF, my favorite restaurant. I just mention it whenever I can. The government pays me to do that. Tomorrow on the show, Cliff Schechter, that other guy. Chris, whatever his name is. Maybe we'll have another guest. I don't know. Don't forget justcoffee.coop. 10% discount code. We've used the coupon code majority in the coupon box. And buy your junk that you buy on Amazon through our links. Do us all a favor. All right, folks. See you on the flip side.